When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Acclaimed crime historian, podcaster, and author of American Sherlock, Kate Winkler Dawson tells the thrilling story of Edward Roloff, a serial murderer who was called too intelligent to be killed, and the array of 19th century investigators who were convinced his brain held the key to finally understanding the criminal mind. Edward Roloff was a brilliant yet utterly amoral murderer. Some have called him a Victorian-era Hannibal Lecter, whose crimes spanned decades and whose victims were chosen out of revenge, out of envy, and sometimes out of necessity. From his humble beginnings in upstate New York to the dazzling salons and social life he established in New York City, at every turn, Roloff used his intelligent and regal bearing to evade detection and avoid punishment. He could talk his way out of any crime, until one day, Roloff's luck ran out. By 1871, Roloff sat chained in his cell, a psychopath holding court while curious 19th century mindhunters tried to understand what made him tick. From alienists, early psychiatrists who tried to analyze the source of his madness, to neurologists who wanted to dissect his brain, to phrenologists who analyzed the bumps on his head to determine his character. Each one thought he held the key to understanding the essential question, is evil born or made? Eventually, Roloff's brain would be placed in a jar at Cornell University as the prized specimen of their anatomy collection, where it still sits today, slowly moldering in a dusty jar. But his story and its implications for the emerging field of criminal psychology were just beginning. Expanded from season one of her hit podcast on the Exactly Right Network, All That Is Wicked, Kate Winkler Dawson draws on hundreds of source materials and never-before-shared historical documents to present one of the first glimpses into the mind of a serial killer. A century before the term was coined, through the scientists whose work would come to influence criminal justice for decades to come. The book that we're featuring this evening is All That Is Wicked, a Gilded Age story of murder and the race to decode the criminal mind, with my special guest, historian and author and podcaster, Kate Winkler Dawson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Kate Winkler Dawson.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this new book. Fascinating story. And right away, I want to ask you, I guess it's obvious from the introduction somewhat, but how you came to want to cover this incredible story?
Well, I have always been fascinated with why people kill. And that's what I do in my podcasts and all of my books, is really analyze that. And I look to history to analyze that and to figure out more answers to these questions. And I ran across Edward Ruloff, I don't even know how long ago. I mean, I've lived with him for 6 or 7 years at this point. And I ran across his story, and I thought that it would be interesting to tell his story because this was someone who defied everything that people thought a criminal was in the 19th century. They thought a killer was a killer who was disheveled and wild-eyed and somebody who you could spot easily, not your neighbor or your teacher or your husband or the, you know, your in-law. These are all things that were, when it was discovered, were stunning to the people, not just in upstate New York or in America, but around the world, because this was a man who looked like everyone else. Even more disturbing was he was smarter than everyone else, and he carried himself with eloquence, and he presented as this country gentleman, when really, truly, he was willing to remove any obstacle in his way. And he had such insecurities that he wanted to seek revenge against people who he felt wronged him. And it didn't matter if it were women and children in his wake. So it's a tremendous story for me to tell in a time period that I just love, Gilded Age New York.
You take us back to January 10th, 1871. And in a cell is someone purported to be Edward Howard Ruloff. And the person that is interviewing him is this newspaper person. His name is
Hamilton Freeman.
Yes. Yeah, so Hamilton Freeman has this opportunity to interview who he thinks is Edward Howard Ruloff. And this is right after seeing portions of the trial. So tell us where he is at and where Edward Ruloff is at this time in history.
Well, at this point, we don't know what Edward Ruloff had done to be in this jail. He's being held during his trial. And Hamilton Freeman was just one of the many, many reporters who showed up at the courthouse in Binghamton, New York, to watch this murder trial. And he just became enamored with Ruloff as a subject. He thought that because he represented himself in some instances, he was eloquent. He just, as I said before, defied everything that really people defined a killer to be in the 1800s. And so Hamilton Freeman approached Ruloff and his attorney and said, I want to write your biography. And Ruloff, being someone who, you know, is very clearly out for his own self-interests, agreed because he sensed that Hamilton Freeman was not a cynical New York City reporter. He sensed that he was a small town reporter who was somebody who had the ability to be manipulated very easily. And it's very clear to me and to the forensic psychiatrist I interviewed for this book that Ruloff checked just about every marker for psychopathy, for antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy in the 19th century. And there was no way to diagnose this, of course, back then. But I use this book as a way to trace his actions along with the actions of other serial killers and psychopaths throughout history to show that, unfortunately, and very uncomfortable saying it, that the reasons that people kill have not changed from the 1600s or the 1500s until now. You know, there's jealousy and envy and insecurity and love and sex and money and greed. Those are all things that have just repeated throughout history.
However, this Edward Ruloff is a unique specimen, certainly. When this Freeman, Hamilton Freeman, was interviewing him, he asked along the way in that first interview where he thought that Ruloff's life may have gone off course. What was his response?
Well, he could pinpoint it exactly, and I'm not sure he was really right. Ruloff was born in Canada and had a hard scrabble upbringing, but came from a mother who really had a love for academia and supported him. And things fell apart for him, in my eyes, when his uncle refused to fund his college education. I think that's when he thought things were going to be derailed. Ruloff told Hamilton that things really went off the rails for him when he arrived in New York and he started working as like a helper on the canal, on the Erie Canal. And he met a man named Henry Scutt, who eventually took him home and introduced him to his family. And Ruloff became entrenched in this family and married into it. And he blames the Scutts for everything that has gone wrong in his life. Typical psychopath, typical of someone who has psychopathy, is blaming everybody but himself.
So what was the motivation? You say that you write that Roloff was hesitant to speak to anyone, any journalist. And yet he decided that this would be, Freeman would be the person that would be able to do his biography. What was in it for Freeman other than what was in it for Freeman and what was in it for Roloff? What was their motivations?
Well, since the beginning of time, since the beginning of journalism, journalists and criminals have had a very transactional relationship where, you know, they need each other to a certain extent, at least people who go into prisons and interview. Ted Bundy had two journalists who wrote a book about him, who he gave extensive interviews to. And you know, the motivation for Roloff to get his story out there was he had made a discovery, he believed, in the pattern of how human language was created. And he thought, and other people thought, if you could just figure that pattern out, that it would be very easy to market human language as a way to, you know, you could teach a Frenchman Italian very easily. Right. And this would have been a huge discovery. So Roloff's motivation to have Hamilton Freeman write this biography was, of course, to get his theory out there, to get his life story out there. And Hamilton Freeman was certainly hopeful that it would put him on the map as an accomplished author, which it would have. This would have been a true crime book and a biography that would have, that was very well received. And so I don't know if Hamilton Freeman quite understood the depths of the skill of manipulation that Edward had, but he found out pretty quickly.
And what was the, you talk about the motivation, but what was Roloff's excuse for? Because in this interview, he was asked about the murder of his wife and his daughter. So what was his response to that? What was the reasoning for that?
Well, as he told his life story to Hamilton Freeman, you know, Hamilton really was trying to get at specific details that might clue him in and the readers into why Roloff did this. Because really, that was the big question. How could a man who presented himself the way he did turn around and be a killer? Because if Edward Roloff were a killer, anybody in your life could be a killer. And that was petrifying.
Right.
So when Roloff, leading up to this time, when Roloff describes the argument that he has with his wife while his wife has their essentially newborn child nearby, you know, he's describing this in a very dramatic 19th century manner, lots of flair and, you know, very dramatic. And he does ultimately confess to him, but he gives just enough details of this, the murder that takes place, that he doesn't reveal what happens to his daughter, Priscilla. So there are assumptions, and Ham felt very uncomfortable talking to him about it, but there seems to be very little evidence that Edward had planned and sent her away somewhere else. The conclusion is that most people would have, and I have, is that he ended up killing his daughter also and dropping them both into Cayuga Lake, which is why he was never on trial for their murder. He went on trial for kidnapping. They couldn't prove murder. He was very smart in that way. He covered up the evidence. But I think his motivation for confessing to that particular crime was really to keep Ham's interest. I think he knew that he had to give Ham something. And there are a couple of other murders that happen where Roloff is not so forthright with Ham. But with this one, the way he describes his fight with Harriet, where he is saying, I'm going to create a new life for us out west. I want to take you. I will make you have a better life and we will be happy and free with our daughter. And she reacts in such a verbally violent way to him. I think he framed it in a way that it almost seems logical that he killed her.
Right.
It almost to him seemed that she was destroying their life and it was an act of passion. And I'm not quite sure it went that way in real life. I do think that they had an argument, but I think that this was not an accident. It was an intentional murder that he really maybe had thought about earlier. They had had a lot of acrimony in their marriage. He thought that she was having an affair with her male cousin, which would, the affair would be surprising for me, but the male cousin part is not surprising. It was very common for people to marry who were first cousins. So, you know, Roloff was incredibly jealous of this man, Dr. Bull, and it had just plagued their marriage. So this was a huge trigger for him when she finally said, I'm not going out west. But I do think the way it was framed and the way Hamilton responded was the way Edward wanted him to responded, which is boy, he loved her so much that he was almost left with no choice, you know, but he wouldn't confess to his daughter. And I think that's, he couldn't bring himself to say, I did this to an innocent child. It's all manipulation.
It's incredible, too, to demonstrate or illustrate his psychopathic abilities in terms of being an incredible actor.
Yep.
You write about this, this right out of a horror movie, where despite this family not liking this person whatsoever and suspicious of his background completely and the maltreatment of their sister by this huge family, that still he had made it an impression and had a friendship of sorts with one of the brothers named William. But despite this, they still were at odds with the entire family over this raving over this Dr. Bull. And yet something disastrous happened to William's wife and daughter. Tell us about this extraordinary, horrific scene in this book.
Yeah. And when, you know, when I unravel this, it's something you have to keep in mind, because some of the things that happen are pretty extraordinary. The thing you have to keep in mind is this time period, people believed that a man's handshake was enough to trust him with your life. And they were also, the Skets were very well used to Edward Ruloff's melodramatics. You know, he essentially had hissy fits constantly. So when I tell you what I'm going to tell you about when he's thrown out threats and nobody follows up on it or takes it particularly seriously, it's because they have had so much experience with his threats and nothing's ever happened that they just sort of thought, well, this is just more of this blowhard's reaction to not getting his way. So Edward Ruloff is completely distraught over this affair, which I don't believe actually happened, between Harriet, his wife, and her cousin, Dr. Bull. He's always been threatened by Dr. Bull. Ruloff was a herbal doctor. You know, he would use herbs and it was a botanical doctor. And Dr. Bull was a traditional doctor. And so they were already sort of at odds professionally. But boy, Ruloff really disliked Dr. Bull. Dr. Bull would come in. He was very suave. He would come in and kiss all the women on the cheek. And this just incensed Ruloff, and because he was very insecure. What's one thing that people don't understand about people with psychopathy is they automatically think, well, they're also narcissists. Not true. They're not always narcissists. And in fact, a lot of people with psychopathy have incredibly low self-esteem, and it's masked by this grandiose sense of self, by this glibness that's fake. So Ruloff was incredibly insecure, and he was abusive at times to Harriet, to a point where her brothers intervened and said, essentially, if you don't straighten up, we're taking her back, which, looking through a 21st century lens, is like, yeah, of course. What else are they going to say? In a 19th century lens, that's pretty extraordinary, because once a man marries a woman, she essentially becomes his property. There's little autonomy. So they had to have been very alarmed to say, we are taking her back if you don't straighten up. And you know, Ruloff felt slighted by the family constantly, particularly by her brother, William, who she was very close with. And William had a wife named Amelia. And then Amelia and Priscilla, who was Ruloff's daughter, were born very close together within months. So they were both young babies. Amelia had just given birth, and she and her daughter had both become very sick, which would not have been unusual at all. Childbirths, deaths were very, very common. Of course, these are mostly bacterial infections that happen because they didn't have the same medicines that we have. And William, in the meantime, as Amelia is getting ready to give birth, is interacting with Ruloff. And Ruloff has said, basically, you need to get rid of Dr. Bull because he is trying to seduce my wife. And I think that this needs to stop, and you need to side with me. I'm your brother-in-law. And William said, no, he said this. I don't think this is happening. You're paranoid. You're making this up. You're causing problems in your marriage. And I am tired of hearing about it. And if you continue to complain about an affair that doesn't exist, that I will expel you from this family. So Ruloff was the most dangerous type of person with psychopathy, which was he was smart and he knew when to shut up. And he was high functioning, and he stopped talking and just watched and waited. So when Amelia gave birth to Emil and they both became very sick, William was desperate, and he saw Edward Ruloff at his family's farm, and he said, come with me, please, your doctor, help her. And within a day, she and her daughter were dead. Now, Ruloff could have actually didn't give any explanation for what happened to Ham. He sort of said, well, you know, I gave them medicine and, you know, you kind of cross your fingers. But when they died and his mother-in-law, who was the matriarch of the family, Hannah Scott, was mourning this death, these two deaths, he said to her, you know, I killed them. William Scott did me wrong. Your son did me wrong. And if things don't straighten out soon, then Harriet and my child are next. Now, Hannah did nothing about this because, again, no one believed he was capable of this. No one believed it. He helped plan the funeral. He went there. You would have never been able to detect that something was wrong. That's how good he was. And that's what that lack of remorse and that lack of empathy that he demonstrated that is so prevalent with people with psychopathy also, you know, is makes him an excellent actor.
Now, he was dissatisfied with the family, despite what it, well, given that all the things that had happened, but he would always pine for this opportunity to be in a big city and to have his ideas heard by academic influential people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened when he talks about, at least, a prestigious academy in Ohio offering him a position.
You know, he becomes infuriated when he is given, he's given this incredible opportunity, he says, which is be the head of a boys' academy in Ohio, which hopefully would lead to an opportunity to be a professor at a university. And that was his dream. And that was the dream that had been taken from him, he said, from his uncle when he was young. So this was his chance at redemption. And one thing that's so funny about people with psychopathy, not funny, haha, I guess funny, strange, is I interviewed for a forensic psychologist whose name is Catherine Ramsland.
Right.
And she spent years interviewing Dennis Rader, who was the BTK killer.
Right.
And she said they all do the same thing. They whine. It's the poor me. And she knew Robert Hare, who Crank came up with the checklist. It's called the Hare's Checklist for Psychopathy. And it's the list you go through when you check off, you know, and you on it's on a rating scale. And that's how you decide if somebody has psychopathy. There's no blood test or anything.
Yes.
And she said she had suggested jokingly to Robert Hare that you should add whining to your checklist because they all whine.
Yeah.
And Ruloff whined. And he said, I want to go to Ohio to his wife. You need to come with me. I have been thwarted at every turn. Your family has degraded me and they joke about finding me on the canal as a poor canal worker. And now your wifely duty is to come with me and we're going to bring Priscilla and you're going to have a good life. And she said, no, she said no. And this infuriated him. So this was the trigger for him. And we often talk about killers and any kind of predictability that we can. We're always, as a society, hoping to gather information to be able to, if not predict, at least protect against something that could happen. And so you're looking for those triggers and you're looking for those qualities and the things that should be alarming. And this telling Edward Ruloff that your dream is going to go away because Harriet has the power to say, no, hell no, I'm not going with you. That is what triggered him. It was not her fault. It was totally his fault. But there are usually triggers, even for a serial killer, to start doing something.
Now, the family has already suspicious of Edward and already doesn't like him dramatically. So what happens? What does he say when they are looking for their sister, even after 6 weeks? I know he makes some initial statements, but some of the bizarre behavior that he exhibits, tell us about that.
Well, this comes back to the idea of one forensic psychologist told me that psychopaths foul their own nests eventually. And what that means is that there is only so long that you can keep this mask before it starts to slip. And you cannot emulate real human empathy and emotions for very long before people recognize that you're faking. And that's what they do. And that's what he did. So what he did was he killed his wife and his child. He took their bodies and put them into Cayuga Lake at the deepest part, he said. And he confessed all of this. And this is what he did to cover up the crime. And it worked because the Scutts had missed Harriet and Priscilla for 6 weeks, but they assumed that everything was fine. And this still was an extraordinary long time to not talk to their sister. So Edward Ruloff shows up 6 weeks later after the murders, and he says hi to her two brothers, Ephraim and William Scutt. And they say, "Where is she?" And he says, "She's vacationing between the lakes," which was between the Great Lakes. And he said, "They'll be back at some point." But he stays the night there. He continues to be around. Now, this is a time period that loved snake oil salesmen. They loved frauds in the 19th century and shysters. And it was so easy to be a shyster in that time period. There's no driver's licenses. There's no national identification system. There's no photography, really. And so he could have stepped on a train and gone to Ohio and taken that job and been just fine and disappeared. And they might not have ever been able to track him down. And he could have said they ran away. You know, Harriet had enough of him and took off. But yet he returns. And it is that element of self-sabotage that is so interesting about people with psychopathy. And he does it twice. And people often ask me that, why is he doing that? Why is he doing that? Well, I think that without the Scutts, he didn't have a host. And people that I've spoken to, experts on psychopathy, often call them, like, they'll call them like a virus or, an, you know, a bacteria looking for a host.
Wow.
And without the Scutts, he had no host. And I think he needed them. He needed a resource, and he would come home and he would get food and comfort from them. And he did such odd things. Like, he tried to return a ring to William that William had given his sister. And he said, "Do you want this back?" And William said, "No, it's Harriet's. Why? I don't want it back." So just things that were very odd. He was constant. It's not that he wanted to get caught. I think he just didn't know what else to do. And there was a part of him that felt so insecure without the Scutts that he continued to return.
You write about Ephraim being one of the brothers that has especially always been suspicious and disliked Edward, now is hell-bent on revenge and hell-bent on capturing him. So he goes to extraordinary efforts to be able to do that. Tell us about those efforts.
The efforts you're talking about, it's what the family is most excited to talk to me about now. So, you know, I found Ruloff's family. They still live on the same farm where he lived with Harriet. It's on Scutt Road, which is in Dryden. Mm-hmm. And it's the same creek in the back, the same trees, the same well, you know, all of that is the same. So very almost cathartic for me to walk around that area, the same dirt that man walked on 150 years ago. So the Scutts particularly like this part of the story because it shows a quality that they believe they still have, which is an incredible amount of loyalty for their family and perseverance. So Ruloff finally, because he's returned a couple of times, they become suspicious. And Ephraim and William decide they are going to do something that seems inexplicably complicated to me, which was they're going to keep Ruloff at their house. They're going to force him to write a letter to Harriet, who now he says is in Ohio. They're going to snail mail this letter to Ohio. She will presumably respond, snail mail it back, and everything will be okay. And so, you know, you have to imagine this is going to take this is a long process. Sure. This is not going to be something that's quick. So unfortunately, they left their sister in charge of keeping an eye on him, and he simply walked off and disappeared. And this sends the family into a panic because despite everything in their bones that says there's no way this man, the way he speaks, the way he looks, killed our sister and his daughter, reality is setting in and they decide they need to go and find him. So incredible series of events happen where we have Ephraim rushing from renting horse and carriage to race to train stations, and he hops from train station to train station, and then he gets on the steamers that go across the Great Lakes and eventually tracks Ruloff down, which is just incredible.
Absolutely.
And finds him, and he slips away again. And then there's this pivotal moment once he's recaptured one more time. They're on the steamer together, and they're heading back to New York for certain justice, Ephraim is hoping. And someone finds out on the ship that this is Edward Ruloff, the man who's accused of killing his family, and they want to hang him on the boat. The captain says, "Let's do it. I've got rope. let's do it. All of the passengers on the boat, and Ephraim Scott had such belief, such a deep belief in the justice system that he said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have conventional secular justice, and we're going to do it back in New York. And I'm going to show everybody that I was able to bring him back. Edward Ruloff and Ephraim have a moment on the top deck where they're sitting next to each other. And Ephraim says, I don't understand what happened. You know, we brought you into our family. You married my sister. We gave you every opportunity. We helped you start a school in Dryden when you were very young. We kept you safe. I don't understand why you did this. And really, Ruloff stayed quiet. And then he suggested that he would jump over the edge and take his own life. He would rather do that. And Ephraim essentially snickered and said, go ahead, but I don't think you're going to do it. And he was right. Edward didn't want to do it. So he goes back to face justice. And that's a big question mark, because justice can be funny sometimes.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. But Ritual didn't stop there. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. Now, Ritual has just released Synbiotic Plus, a gut health supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic, all in one minty capsule. My wife Lisa and I have been taking Ritual daily for a few years now. Lisa started with Ritual 18 Plus for women, and when Ritual for Men 15 Plus became available, I started. We were impressed with Ritual's successful clinical trials initially, then impressed with Ritual's overall results, and now impressed taking Synbiotic Plus. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, we were talking, Kate, about his undoing and finally this trial, but you said, let's not, before we get ahead of ourselves, realize what happens at this trial and what the prosecutor was faced with.
Well, he was faced with no bodies is the issue. And we know now that no bodies can be problematic, of course, in a murder trial, because you simply can say, well, she ran off with our daughter and she met a man. And particularly in the 19th century, it would have been very, very difficult to disprove that. But no bodies for Ruloff was no crime. And that's what he harped on. He represented himself in this trial. And there was an unraveling of witnesses who came, and some said he was insanely jealous. Some said he was abusive, but there was simply no evidence. There wasn't even evidence that she died. They examined the place where they lived, the house where they lived, and they couldn't find a bit of blood. He had cleaned it up. And there, again, was no physical evidence. Nobody heard anything. No neighbors saw anything. It would have been difficult today, I believe, to convict him. And in the 19th century, she, like I said, could have gotten on a train and gone anywhere. And you don't want to convict a man, and particularly convict a man of murder in the 19th century, where it would have been a death sentence, have that happen, and then have her walk back in a year later. So they were very careful about that. The district attorney did something interesting. He told the jury that they could have two choices. They could convict him of murder, which of course would have been his preference. He would have convicted him of murder, which would have been the death penalty, or you could convict him of a lesser crime, which was kidnapping, and that would have given him 10 years at an Auburn State prison. And so when the case was done and Ruloff said over and over again, no body, no crime, the conviction was for 10 years for the kidnapping. It wasn't for murder. And the judge kind of cornered the jury, and he talked to the jury foreman and said, I don't understand. How could you convict him for kidnapping and not murder? And he said, there's not enough evidence for murder, but we knew he did something. we believe he killed her, but there wasn't enough evidence, which I thought was very interesting. So we went with the smaller time so that at least we could get him for something. So he was convicted and sent to Auburn State Prison, which was one of the best things that had ever happened to him.
What characterized his time there and why? And you talk about, write about him thriving in prison. How was that?
Well, he loved prison. I mean, which just sounds so interesting. Auburn State Prison at that time period was implementing an interesting way of handling prisoners, which was imposed silence. So everybody had their own cell. They didn't share cells. And they were not allowed to talk. It was like being in a silent monastery, I suppose. They weren't allowed to talk. They couldn't even talk when they ate together. And Edward loved it because he had become obsessed with languages at such a young age. When you're married and you have a child and you have a job as a botanical doctor and as a teacher and you're giving lectures on phrenology and language, you don't have time to work on really serious academic pursuits. And now he did. He had 10 years of quiet, of 3 meals a day. And he actually became a carpet designer in prison, and he was paid a lot of money for these designs because he was so creative. He invented a few new things, including a gun in prison. He was able to figure out how to make a gun, and he never used it, but these little inventions became useful for him later on. So while in prison, he woke up one morning and there was like a ding ding moment where he realized that he could figure out the origin of human language, which was a really big question mark. Mm-hmm. And he believed that there was a manufactured from Europe pattern that all language was created on. So he thought that the letters R and F were very important, which I'm sure is no coincidence because those letters were in his last name. And he had a really interesting idea about how language was formed. And if you could figure that pattern out, then you could really leverage that in teaching languages, which would have been a $1 million idea in the 1800s. So this was a dream for him. And now he had 10 years to write on this manuscript, which he titled The Method and Formation of Human Language. And he had these 10 years with making some money as a carpet maker, carpet designer, living in silence, eating well, being fairly healthy while he was there. He worked in the kitchen. I mean, this was not a bad life. And Auburn State Prison had a terrible reputation. I mean, it looked like this gothic out of hell type, you know, scenario. Mm-hmm. And he really benefited from it. He really, really used his time well there.
Talk about using his time well. He was respected as a very knowledgeable academic, and he also designed or offered to be able to teach people and tutor people in there. What did that lead to in terms of relationships?
Well, when he got out of Auburn State Prison with his manuscript in hand, he decided he wanted to start a new life, and he was going to leave upstate New York, which was a fantastic idea. He didn't need to stay around. However, the Scutts had pressured for so long the district attorney to file new charges. He had been charged with killing his wife. He was convicted of kidnapping her. Then he became charged as soon as he was released after 10 years for killing his daughter. This mm-hmm. never went anywhere. There wasn't enough evidence. They couldn't even figure out how she died, if she died at all. So eventually, Ruloff had to be jailed while awaiting trial. And there was a lot of appeals and so on. So he was jailed in Ithaca. The undersheriff, which was like a deputy sheriff, had a family, a wife and a child. And Ruloff had volunteered, or was asked, I'm not sure which, to tutor the young people in Ithaca because, right, what you said was he was this well-known scholar. So these people in Ithaca who wanted to kill him, they wanted him strung up at the gallows, were now allowing their children, their teenagers, to come and be tutored in languages by him, which I just find so bizarre. And one of the people who was tutored was the undersheriff's son, whose name was Al Jarvis. And he was a young man who, you know, I sounds like had some troubles in the past, but had a lot of potential. He's very good looking. He was enamored with Ruloff and vice versa. And he ran errands for Ruloff. And in the meantime, Edward Ruloff, who's shackled in this jail, is seducing the undersheriff's wife so Al Jarvis's mother. And it all results in Edward Ruloff breaking out of jail in the middle of the night with their help and going on the run.
He goes on the run, and you write about the state of 1870s. You had mentioned before there was no method of identification and photography was quite new. Tell us about his reinvention.
Well, he was so interesting. He went on the run, and first he went to Pennsylvania where his brother was, and he's tromping through the snow. And this becomes important to the story later on. He's tromping through the snow and he's not dressed well for the snow. And he has frostbite, and one of his toes on his foot is succumbs to frostbite.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up with his brother and he's bored. He would have been safe probably staying with Ruloff. His brother's name was Ruloff Rulofson. He would have been fine staying with his brother, but he ventures off and goes to Allegheny College under the name Professor James Nelson. Allegheny College was headed by a president who was from England. Ruloff didn't know this, and he feigned an English accent.
Oh.
And the president from England bought it. He just said, okay, this guy's great. He had him teach language classes as kind of an adjunct. And then Ruloff said, well, I really want, and he's on the run the whole time.
Wow.
He said, I really want a full-time faculty position here. And the president said, we can't give you that. We don't have an opening, but let me look around. And he poked around, and eventually Professor James Nelson was offered a full-time faculty position in North Carolina at a university there. So this is a man who has escaped a murder sentence, who's awaiting trial to potentially go on trial for his daughter's murder. And he has made up a totally new name, and he is gone and now has accepted a faculty position in North Carolina.
What happens in the interim?
Well, he gets derailed thanks to Al Jarvis and Al's mother. So after his escape, the undersheriff puts two and two together and figures out that his wife and his son had aided in this.
Mm-hmm.
He's furious. He kicks him out. And Al Jarvis and the mother snail mail, of course, Ruloff, and they know where he was. He had kept in touch with them. And Al Jarvis said, you're going to help us or I'm going to kill you, which is why when I read portraits of Al Jarvis as being this nice boy who's been corrupted by Edward Ruloff, not quite the case.
Sure.
He had some problems beforehand. So Al Jarvis says, I'm going to kill you. I'll slit your throat next time I see you if you don't help us. So instead of getting on the train to North Carolina, Ruloff essentially robs a jewelry store and eventually gets caught and eventually gets sent back to Ithaca and then gets off. The New York State Supreme Court came back and said, we cannot prosecute him for murdering his daughter. And there's not enough evidence, no body, no crime. So he wasn't going to be charged there. The escape was sort of blown off. The undersheriff had decided to please not press charges. It was too embarrassing already. He was already humiliated. And then the jewelry store owner had gotten back all of his jewels. So there was no motivation for him to prosecute. So that was it. He walked out. He was released. And then he disappeared from upstate New York and reappeared in New York City.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you say he disappeared, but this relationship with Al Jarvis and then a new person named Billy Dexter arises. Tell us about this new relationship.
So Ruloff ends up in the 1860s in New York, and Al Jarvis eventually, they make up and he comes with him, and they operate a crime ring, they start gathering other criminals because Ruloff says one simple thing. I have this manuscript. I need the time to finish it. New York is the place for me. There's libraries all over the place that I can use, but I need money. And so he creates this little crime ring with the promise that if you go out and rob silk merchants, sell their wares, help support me, and let me have this apartment in Irving Place, that I will, when I make $1 million off of this manuscript, I will repay you, essentially. So they have a boxer whose name, or they have a, what they called an illiterate boxer named Billy Jarvis, who was a really interesting character. He was very rough and tumble, but he had an interest in higher education. And Ruloff met him in prison. Ruloff was in and out of prison. So was Al Jarvis, but they were under fictitious names. There was no records check. They couldn't figure out who was who. Right. So Ruloff met Billy Dexter in prison. So Al Jarvis and Billy Dexter and Ruloff would go and rob silk merchants in upstate New York in the countryside. They collected a couple of other criminals to help. There was a woman who cooked for them, but also fenced their silk for them. They had another guy who was helping rob stuff. And in the meantime, Ruloff is spending all night long writing his manuscript. So they've created this crime ring just to fund his academic research, which was very interesting. And then there's this fateful turn where they rob a silk merchant in Binghamton, New York, in upstate New York. And they don't understand how chloroform works. And they think that they have knocked out the two young male clerks who are babysitting the silk, and they did not. And ensues this horrific fight between these three robbers, including Ruloff and these two clerks. And it turns into total mayhem and ends fatally for three out of the five people involved.
He isn't arrested immediately, but tell us about this arrest and this upcoming trial.
Well, there's a dead clerk, and then Ruloff's two, you know, co-robbers, Billy Dexter and Al Jarvis, drown, although there are people who think that Ruloff actually caused them to drown in the river behind the clerks, the river behind the silk merchant. So he is eventually located. Not a very distinguished hiding place. He was in an outhouse and he was discovered, but nobody knew who he was. And he is asked to identify the two dead robbers from the river. And he says, I don't know who they are, even though he knew perfectly well who they were. So he is dragged in along with all the other ne'er-do-wells in town to essentially stand trial. Somebody is responsible for this dead clerk and these two robbers. And so there's not enough evidence against really anyone. And the judge tells Ruloff, who he gave a fictitious name, the judge tells Ruloff, go on and go. And so he turns and there's a voice that says, stop. Mm-hmm. And he turns around and he realizes that one of the judges in his trial is standing in that courtroom. And he says, you are Edward Ruloff. I know exactly who you are. You killed your wife and your child. And Ruloff is just brilliant because he says, yeah, you're right. That's exactly who I am. Now, do you understand why I made up a name? I happen to be in this town and there's a dead clerk. No, I didn't have anything to do with that, but I lied because everybody's going to assume I was involved. So it was this man was very quick thinking on his feet. Pretty remarkable turn. And he almost got away with it.
You say almost. Tell us about some of the features of this most incredible trial eventually.
Well, you know, they locate the robber who was the only surviving robber left behind a funny shoe, a leather patent shoe, and it was specially made to fit someone who was missing one toe.
Right.
And so before Ruloff left town, they snagged him again and they looked at his foot and it matched the shoe perfectly because he was missing that one toe. And he goes on trial and it's pretty extraordinary. You know, he represents himself, which is usually not a very good idea. Ted Bundy also represented himself for some of his trials. And this happens. This is another trait of people with psychopathy. They have this, again, this false, grandiose sense of self where they are much smarter than they actually are. And Ruloff had some great arguments. He essentially said this was self-defense. These clerks fought with me. And, you know, I eventually had to protect myself. So the trial was interesting. He eventually was convicted, and it's what happens after the trial that really is the crux of the book, which is now he's being scheduled to be executed. But you have groups of men who say, I don't think this is a good idea. He's very smart. He's promising us he has this manuscript that's life-changing for languages. Let's not kill him. Let's figure out a way to harness his brain for good instead of evil.
Let's talk about some of those people, what they found and what they determined, and just some of the particulars of speaking with Edward Ruloff.
You know, Edward Ruloff was a master manipulator. That's a trait for people who have psychopathy, and he really was. Every time someone came in, he could read them very quickly, figured out what they wanted from him, and then provide that. So they all left with different impressions. So there was the journalist Hamilton Freeman, who was manipulated to a point where he went to the governor to try to save Ruloff's life, which is a big no-no for a journalist.
Sure.
He really inserted himself in Ruloff's life. There was a reporter named Oliver Dyer who was with the New York Sun, and Oliver really believed in the theory and his writing, and he published incredibly large, in-depth excerpts of Ruloff's theory in the newspapers, which swayed the public in his favor. There was a psychiatrist whose name was John Gray. He was very notorious. He was the nation's most well-known psychiatrist, and he believed in the biology theory. So the biology theory was that if your body was sick, then you had a mental illness, most likely. If your body was healthy, then your mind was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came in and examined Ruloff's body, which was not in great shape. I mean, Ruloff really had some big health issues, but Ruloff understood that theory well enough to know that he did not want to be deemed insane. If he were deemed insane, he would be sent to an asylum, which was about one step above being executed. Asylums, sure, including Gray's asylum, were not really good. But the most important thing was, yes, that would save his life if he were deemed insane, legally insane, but it would discredit all of his research. Nobody would believe that a quote-unquote crazy man would have written anything of value. So he lied about his physical condition because he knew that Gray would call him insane. So every person he encountered, he never confessed to anyone but Hamilton Freeman.
Mm.
He, you know, spoke eloquently about linguistics to Oliver Dyer, but he knew that Oliver Dyer was very religious. And so he never admitted that he was an atheist to Oliver Dyer when people would ask. To John Gray and to another psychologist, he questioned the existence of God. That was safe with them because they weren't particularly religious, right?
Mm.
But not with Oliver Dyer, who he was hoping to leverage with the media. So with every different person he encountered, they all walked away with, you know, a different opinion. The closest that they came to of being correct about who he was they called it moral insanity, which means your body is healthy, right? You don't have a mental illness, but you have some pretty messed up morals. And the morals that you have been given by God have led you astray, which is, again, comes back to nature versus nurture and the belief at the time that people were born bad. They were born to be killers. They were born evil. So that is the closest thing to psychopathy, I think, that we have in that story, because nobody knew what psychopathy was. And he fits every single marker to a T.
One of those people that examined Edward was William Hammond, and he was an enemy of this John Gray, Dr. Gray, and was opposed in his theories and ideas. And you also talk about this phrenology and the concept behind it, but you write a little bit later what it inadvertently led to in terms of forensic psychology today.
Yeah, I mean, those are both interesting. So you go back and think about a 19th century psychiatry. It was a big fight between the psychiatrists who run the asylums, like John Gray, who were doing really terrible things, forced medicine, and, you know, they were putting people in cages. Some of it was incredibly inhumane, what was happening
sure.
with psychiatrists at different institutions. If you had, you know, some illness, they would cut different body parts off of you in hopes of curing it. Now, on the flip side is you have the neurologists like William Hammond, who studied the brain after you died. John Gray would study you while you were alive, and William Hammond would study you after you died. And what the nine neurologists were saying is that we have the ability to work with people who are mentally ill better than the psychiatrists do, because we're trying to learn what's actually happening with the brain. And so the neurologists were at the forefront of this. The people who were far, far, far behind were the precursors to psychologists, which were phrenologists. So the phrenologists were looking at people's bumps on their skulls, feeling for bumps, and then also looking at brains of people who had died. And they're assigning different qualities, why we behave in which ways, to different parts of the brain based on the bumps on your skull. So if you have dominant bumps on the back of your skull, that might be what I think they called it, your animalistic section, which means, you know, if you're bumpy back there, then you probably could kill someone. And there's a moral section and there's a benevolence section. None of it makes sense. And all of it was incorrect. However, there are parts of our brain that govern different parts of, you know, really different qualities that we have. So that was correct. The problem that we have with phrenology is based on bumps, they could predict, they claimed, who a young person who would go on to be a killer and who would be a minister. And you can imagine for the people who they predicted to be killers or have a large animal brain, how uncomfortable that made them. And it was certainly part of scientific racism, using your body parts to assign intelligence to you.
Right. Now, he was sentenced to die and he could hear the gallows being built outside the prison. He knew the public disdain for him, and the media was whipping up stories of that ilk. What was his goal still at this time, just not long before his slated execution? What was his goal? And he had seduced journalists and he had seduced influential academic people. Who comes in to say that he's a fraud?
Well, there's a language expert who says, you know, who is George Sawyer, who says that this manuscript is worthless and he's not as smart as he thinks he is. And he messed up a couple of translations I asked him to do. I mean, that's what's the most interesting thing is they're giving insanity tests based on how well he translates passages of Greek.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. So, yeah. You know, I think the bottom line is that you have someone that, somebody like Edward Ruloff, who ultimately his theory was worthless, had some crazy ideas. Now, I've had linguistics experts tell me that his ideas were no more crazy than some of the other ideas that people had about linguistics. He got several things right that other people had not had. There was still the belief in the 1900s that Homer was written, that the Iliad, who, you know, Homer wrote, was Homer was one person. And Ruloff said, no, it was multiple people. And he was right. So there are some things that he got right about theories. The bottom line was that Edward Ruloff was incredibly smart. He was not right about this manuscript, but he was so bright that if he had had a normal brain, if he had been able to work with other people of his caliber, he probably could have made some incredible discoveries. But his hubris, his ego, or his lack of self-esteem wouldn't allow him to do that.
What about this person named Mather? Henry Mather.
Yeah, Richard Henry Mather really actually believed in Ruloff. He saw in him the potential, this incredible potential for languages, but he was frightened of him. At the very end of their interview together, Mather said, this is a brilliant man who speaks so eloquently about languages, but you can also look in his eyes and see that he is imbued by the devil, that this is someone who, you know, is someone you want to stay away from. He has a coldness about him. So again, that intersection, incredible intelligence and cold-heartedness, was something that fascinated people in the 19th century.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about All That Is Wicked, A Gilded Age Story of Murder, and The Race to Decode the Criminal Mind. Thank you so much, Kate Winkler Dawson. Could you tell us just before you go about your podcast and when this book will be released?
The book comes out on Tuesday, October 4th, and I have three podcasts. One is called Tenfold More Wicked, and it's sort of a documentary series where I take one crime from history and talk to the family and interview experts. The other podcast is called Wicked Words, where I interview journalists about their best true crime stories. And then the podcast that was just released a couple of weeks ago is with forensic investigator Paul Holes, and that is called Buried Bones. And I present Paul with a case with a lot of mystery, and he gives me a 21st century investigator's opinion on what went wrong and what went right from cases over a couple hundred years ago.
Thank you so much, Kate Winkler Dawson. It's been a pleasure. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.